Like to welcome everyone to episode 6 of our podcast, Two Men and a Bible Fighting the Cosmic Battle. I'm Jamie Sanchez, and again I'm joined with by Pastor Bob Brandon, and we're going to go through Genesis chapter 6, verse 1 through 8 today.
All right.
Man, some big medicine.
As usual, like we said earlier, the book of Genesis is just foundational to everything else that happens in the scriptures. So there's, as we continue on with our broadcast, there will be times where we'll be covering 2, 3, 4, 5 chapters at a time.
Right.
Some material is spread out like that. But Genesis, these early nuggets are crucial. So only 8 verses today, but they're an important 8 verses.
Extremely important in the cosmic battle, in the sense of the cosmic battle.
That's right. Well, yes, boy, I don't know the right words for it, but the cosmic battle is going to be a full relief in this passage today. It's right up front.
It's at the head of the table today.
Yes.
As I was reading the passages for today, Bob, it really rang true to me what really our job is and what we're talking about when we talk about the cosmic battle. You know, what they were going through in their time is very, very much the same as what we're going through now, it seems to me.
Cultures change and so on, but fundamentally human nature doesn't change, and the angelic realm does not change. So,
yeah, which we're going to talk about today.
Right.
Holy cow.
Yeah, they broke some boundaries.
Well, with that being said, shall we dive in?
Let's dive in. The best way to do it this time is our usual pattern. Let's just read the verses straight through, and then we'll talk them through.
Beautiful.
So this is Genesis 6, verses 1 through 8. Now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. They took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. And then the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil, continually. The Lord was sorry that he'd made man on the earth. He was grieved in his heart. The Lord said, I will blot out man, whom I've created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I've made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So,
holy.
That's our passage. Lots to understand in there. Let's do this first of all.
Okay.
let me point this out. One of the things that you have to do to be a good reader of the Bible is pick up on their patterns and pick up on their style, so we can get the things that Moses is emphasizing. So, do you remember back in the garden in Genesis 3, verse 5, where the serpent tempted Eve? And they have the little dialogue, and then it describes the act, and it says that Eve saw that the fruit was good, you know, to make one wise, and then so she took the fruit and ate it. So those two verbs, she saw and took. So look at verse 2 in our passage this morning, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves. It's the same, it's so parallel. It's the exact same kind of act. You know, the seeing and taking. In other words, it's describing lust. You know, breaking the boundaries that God has set. The same thing that Eve did.
Interesting.
Same thing that Eve did.
I would have never have drawn that parallel?
Well, their language, the Hebrew language, is simple in the sense that it's based quite a bit on repetition as far as their narrative style, and it's based on structure, and we'll continue to point those things out. But repetition's important to them. So that same combination of seeing and taking, as God set that up very early on, is going to be a significant pattern.
So a listener in these days would have seen that and then had drawn the parallel immediately? Is that what would happen?
I think the sharp ones would have. Yeah, they were trained to hear and listen to their literature in that way. Remember, again, you know, we often point this out, and it's kind of funny, like with our own children. Sophia's got 1,000 things to occupy her mind. Yeah, she's got her Game Boy thing, and she's got the computer, and she's got her phone, and so on. What did they have in 1500 B.C.? They don't have TV. They don't have radio. So they're very used to this type of communication. So, yeah, they'd have picked up on those subtleties.
So now going back to the first verse today, so now it came about when man began to multiply. So something that I forget to keep in context is how long people were actually living, what the longevity of man was at that time. And as you pointed out to me so often, you know, if you were here 700 years, how many kids would you have?
Yeah.
So,
and that was your goal,
right?
Pretty much, to have children is feeling the command God has placed on mankind to fill the earth, you know, be fruitful, multiply, subdue it. So your goal is to reproduce. And yeah, you'd have a lot.
Well, and I think it's important to remember as we went through the lineage last week, that Noah is from the line or the house of
yes.
Seth.
Yeah,
is
that's
that,
right.
Is that how we'd say that?
That's right.
And which is important to understand if you understand what happened between Cain and Abel.
Yeah, that he's, Seth was the replacement for Abel. You sort of get that idea in the text. And then his lineage is the more godly lineage. I don't know if we can go quite as far as actually identifying them as the seed of the woman as opposed to the seed of the serpent coming through Cain, but pretty close. You get pretty close to making that identification.
And I think it points out that, you know, Seth, after Seth, men began to call on the name of the Lord.
It says that in his line. That's right. And so here you get to Noah, which will dominate us for the next few chapters with the flood account. But Noah's, it says in our verse, Noah found favor in the, excuse me, in the eyes of the Lord. Literally, it's the word grace. Noah found grace.
Now, I've got to put a big halt here, and I need some big explanation on verse 2. The sons of God saw that the daughters of men... Who are the sons of God?
We got a pretty good idea who the daughters of men are, right?
Right.
Because they're beautiful, and we all know that.
Right.
We've got beautiful daughters, and yeah. So the sons of God, there's basically been three different interpretations of this down through history. The oldest, which is the one I tend towards, is that these are angels. And when we say angels, keep in mind, I'm not distinguishing often when I say that between fallen angel and good angel. There's good guys and bad guys
okay.
in the angelic realm. The bad guys are demons.
Right.
But I just generally use the word angel to mean that whole realm without necessarily specifying.
So talking about that whole spiritual...
It's the angelic realm. The sons of God is the angelic realm. And here, you know, a good angel is not going to do what these guys did. So we could say this is demonic.
Now, sons of God, are they the cherubim? Or are they... Are they there? Or where are they at?
Cherubim is English word, of course, that's almost directly drawn from the Hebrew. The Hebrew word... that the English word comes from is karav. And that means, the root of that word means to be near. So the karabim, the im on the end of the word is their plural. It's the equivalent of our s on a noun. So the cherubs, or the karabim, were the angels closest to God. They were, and in rank, the highest ranking angels. Satan is a cherub, for instance. Michael,
okay.
The archangel, is a cherub. I forget the other angel, Gabriel, probably. We don't know necessarily, but it seems like those guys were cherubs. Satan is actually mentioned as a cherub. So.
Now, sons of God, are they next below the
sons
cherubs?
Of God would include all of that. It
all
just means angelic realm without specifying the rank. There's another rank of angels that we notice in the scriptures, seraphim. And again, that's an English word out of the transliterated from the Hebrew word saraf, which means to burn. So they're the flaming ones. They're the ones that look like fire. And so some people would rank the highest ranking angels a cherub. That's pretty certain. And then perhaps second highest is a seraphim. We don't know that for sure, but may well be the case. Paul, once you get to the New Testament, will list them as rulers and powers and authorities and so on. But apparently there's rank.
So the sons of God are definitely jumping the fence here, right?
That's a good way to say that. But the reason I say fairly strongly that I think this is the angelic realm is Job uses the term exactly that. You know, and you're familiar with that story,
yes.
Right? There was a day when the sons of God presented themselves before the Lord, and that's the council. The angels make up the council members, and there's God at his board meeting dictating things. There's good biblical precedent for taking it as angels. So here's the other view then. some people down through the centuries just think, well, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. How can angels have intercourse with human beings? So it can't be that, regardless of the fact that it looks like that on the surface. It can't be that. So sons of God must be a reference to like really powerful humans, like these were the early kings. They were bigger and stronger than anybody else, and so they took for themselves wives of whomever they wanted. You know, if you were married, mm-hmm. and you're married to Jen, and here's some big powerful guy, you know, I like Jen, I'm gonna take her. That kind of thing. That there was just a dominance of the early heroes that were on the earth. You know, something like those who were like Lamech, that was pointed out in Cain's line, right? If anybody
right.
messes with me, you know, they're gonna die. I've killed men for offending me. So he would be an example of like a hero of old, you know, a dominating male. So some people take that line, and then some people take it that it was actually the godly kings of the line of Seth. And God became angry that they were just marrying whomever they wanted, and similar to the powerful human kind of view. And those are the three views down through history. I favor the first one, as strange as it sounds. It fits perfectly with the cosmic battle.
Well, the
it's
picture
very strange to us, but it fits perfectly with what's been revealed so far.
And the picture that they're painting, and you know, you have a better grasp of, you know, this time in history than I do. What is really going on? Am I seeing chaos? That's what I see in my head when I read these words and I see a picture. I'm seeing chaos and disorder, as we talked about earlier.
Well, that's true. I want you to interact with this. I'm going to quote at length a page worth of a guy named Alan Ross, great professor of the Old Testament. Here's what he has said concerning this passage, and I think it's the best stuff you could find on it. So let me read for a few minutes and then interact with what he's saying. Alan Ross, in the book Creation and Blessing, which is a commentary on Genesis, says this: "I find most attractive a combination of the angel view and the despot view." And pause there for a second. That despot view is the second one I mentioned. That these were powerful kings on the earth.
Okay.
"Fallen angels left their habitation and indwelt human despots and warriors, the great ones of the earth. We know from Daniel 10:13, from Daniel 10:20, that great kings and the kingdoms of the earth had princes, in quotes, ruling behind them." In other words, angelic powers. "Powerful spirits with whom Michael had to fight. We also know from Ezekiel 28:11-19, that the king of Tyre may have been associated in the prophet's mind with Satan, the anointed cherub. It's no surprise that in the literature of the ancient Near East, kings were described as divine, half-divine, or demigods. Pagans revered such great leaders as gods or as offspring of the gods. In Ugaritic, the sons of the gods refers to members of the pantheon, as well as great kings of the earth. Accordingly, any superhuman individual or giant would suggest to the ancient people some kind of unusual origin. The view that interprets the sons of God solely as powerful rulers does not, in my opinion, make enough use of the literary connections with pagan literature. The expression sons of God was taken in context of these verses, and when viewed against the background of the ancient Near East, suggests that more than powerful rulers are involved. Moreover, the expression in the Bible refers to angels, like he's referring to Job, like we said earlier. If this analysis is correct, then we have in the story an explanation of how corrupt the world got when this unparalleled violation took place. And that's what you were just describing to me. Furthermore, the story would also become a polemic against subsequent beliefs of the pagans that giants, powerful rulers, and men of renown were of divine origin, and that immortality was achieved by hubris and immorality. The entire cult of the Canaanites was centered on fertility rites by sympathetic magic in which people engaged in sexual intercourse with the officials at the temple. As Israel encountered such corruption, she had the law of God, which stressed that separation of such sexual activities from the sanctuary and denied that divinity could be achieved by defying God's barriers. Let's pause there a sec, then I'll read some more. So you see, again, how I'll often say you got to get back into 1500 BC,
right.
And here's Israel coming out of Egypt, and God has been describing how corrupt the whole thing was. And they're going into a land called Canaan, and the people that inhabit that land have these kind of practices. And they think that there are strong, powerful leaders who indulge in all kind of bizarre sexual activity and so on because they're bigger and stronger than anybody else. And they attribute it to, well, that's because we're divine and we're allowed to do this. You can see God saying, that's nuts. There's nothing divine about that. It's not what I want. In fact, it's blasphemous to me. And it angered me so bad at one point that I wiped out the whole world. I mean, that's what he's saying. There's no divinity involved in being a hero on earth.
Right.
That's what he's saying. That's the main message. So let's finish this out. The polemic, and you know what we mean by that word, like warning the Israelites. It's taking a stand. A polemic is like taking a stance against another view. So the polemic would then be saying that the sons of God that the pagans often spoke of were not lesser gods of the pantheon who entered the world of humans for their pleasure. Rather, the sons of God were basically human beings, the offspring of this union. There may have been demonic or spirit activity or power behind them, but they were just another low order of humans. They're taking any women they wished. For instance, this might be like the beginning of harems. Right? So they're taking any woman they wished was an attempt to satisfy their baser instincts. The offspring of these marriages may have been famous and powerful, but contrary to popular thinking, they were not God kings. They were flesh. As the text states, they would die in due course like all members of the human race. When God judged the world, as he subsequently did, no giant, no alleged deity, no pagan ideology would have power against him. God simply allotted the days and announced the end. Here then, humankind had overstepped the boundaries again, trying to assume the role of divinity and hoping to achieve immortality. God, through Moses, set the record straight by confronting the mythological ideas directly. Do not believe the Gentile myths concerning the divine origin of the men of renown. In the end, all must die, for all are flesh. That's what's going on.
That pretty well sums it up, that last sentence.
Yeah, and see, there's a twofold responsibility. If these were demons coming down to do this, we're going to talk about that a little more in a second, but it also says that the men were involved in giving to them. Now, it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took for themselves whomever they chose. Where's the dad stepping in and going, hey, you can't take my daughter like that, or, right? It seems like that there's compliance on the part of mankind,
if,
at least
not supportive.
On the part of the women.
If not supportive, I think, which goes to what we talk about a lot, is thinking that the powers or riches or wealths that are associated with the planet are what really that we want, when that couldn't even be further from the truth.
That's right. Yeah.
So they were a little off path, can we say that at this point?
Well, they're breaking major boundaries, right? They're
huge.
Not staying within their boundaries. And God has placed boundaries around us in many ways. And it's never a good idea to break out of that. In fact, when we even have that kind of discussion, you're really in the realm of what they would call in the ancient Near East wisdom. So wisdom fundamentally was that which strengthened the natural order of things. And so foolishness, it's the opposite of wisdom, would be that which breaks the natural order of things. And there's another idea that's prominent in the passage. The Lord says verse 5. And then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And that word evil is a theme that Moses has been developing. It's important that any listener has a good, well-developed idea, conception of what evil is. So I'd like to define that for us. If I can find it here just for a second, I wrote it down. It's fairly simple. Evil is the lie which opposes God. Now, it results in actions, but the essence of all evil is the lie. And we saw that in Genesis 3, right? The essence of the serpent's temptation hinged on this key concept when he said to Eve that you would not die if you ate from this fruit. And God had clearly said, you will die. And he said, you wouldn't. So there's the lie. The reason the temptation was powerful is because there was a lot of truth in it. You know, oh, look, this will make you wise, and that's good, and so on. And all that's true. But it won't do that as you break the rules of God. It won't do that. So the essence of evil is a lie. All evil actions ultimately stem from believing a lie at some level. And
it encompasses the way that you explained it there. The picture I saw was it's encompassed by that separation that is created. The evil separates you even further from God. That separation that we talk about in Genesis 3.
No, evil is the lie which opposes God. So in other words, let's apply that for a second. So how do you fight evil? Right? It's not go around, put out fires, you know, be a superhero, Mr. Incredible, you know, defeat the villains and so on. That's not bad. That helps in the battle, but that'll never... That's like pulling out one weed and two more spring up in its place. The way you ultimately have to fight evil is with the truth. If the essence of evil is a lie, which opposes God, then the only way to successfully fight that is with the truth. And as we've defined it before, truth is that which corresponds to reality. And a lie, then, is that which doesn't correspond to reality.
Well, and I think that's an important definition to understand within the cosmic battle.
It's fundamental to it.
Absolutely. Now, Nephilim, quickly for our listeners, what's the definition of Nephilim?
Okay,
you know,
Nephilim?
So many times we can read through this, and as you say a lot, it takes on a fairy tale kind of feel to it.
Yeah. Well, you can already tell it sounds like some of the words we mentioned this morning. Cherubim, seraphim, here's Nephilim. So the I-M at the end is just plural. And Nephilim is just a transliteration. In other words, it's put It's taking the Hebrew letters and putting them directly into English. The Hebrew word is nafal, and that means to fall. So this is the fallen ones.
So more...
A reference to the demonic realm. The fallen
again.
Ones were on the... Yeah.
And they're running around.
And it seems like this word here, it's applied to the offspring of the demons and the women, the fallen ones. Whereas in the ancient Near East at that time, they'd have held them up as great heroes. And here's the Bible saying they're not great heroes. These are the fallen ones.
Seed of the serpent?
Directly.
Directly
in this case.
Right?
Yeah, directly in this case. You know what's a good mental picture to keep in mind? I know I've asked you this before and I've forgotten your answer, but have you seen 300?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, you have. So the way Xerxes is pictured, right? That's the picture in the ancient Near East of a great king. And the way they filmed it, they make him look like a giant.
Right.
Right? I mean, he looks like he's 9 feet tall or something. So that's a Nephilim. That's one of these race of giants that dominated the earth. You know, and they're so prideful, and they take whomever they wish, you know, and they elevate whom they wish, and they suppress whom they wish, and, you know, they're just this prideful rule. That's a good picture to have in mind of what the Bible means by the Nephilim, a fallen one like that.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of what I'm getting out of this is there's a whole planet full of this chaos going on at this point in time.
That's right. That's right. And I think the underlying purpose for that on the part of the demons, and it's not just the lust of Hades women look good. I think it's also that they're trying to pollute the race. Because God had said in Genesis 3, you know, the seed of the woman is going to crush the seed of the serpent. So they're aware of this battle that's going on and their ultimate doom, and they're trying to forestall that.
And that hierarchy that you point out so many times,
yeah.
God, man, angels, creation.
That's right, and they're blurring all those lines.
And they want to erase it.
Yeah.
Because I guess there's the pride, is that envy, you know, all those bad things.
I think it's all of those things. That's right.
And so, as we get down to verse 6, the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. I can't even imagine what that would feel like.
The Lord's sorrow?
Yes.
Yeah, the only way we can approximate it is, you know, when you watch your own children goof up.
Right.
Goof up, what a word, you know, that minimizes what we're really talking about. But see, at some point, you have to let your children choose. I think you should give them quite a bit of instruction first, but ultimately, they have a will.
Right.
And you're not doing them any favors if you keep them under your thumb forever. And as soon as you let them choose, there's that possibility that they'll choose wrongly. And when you watch that happen, it hurts. And so you imagine the Lord looking down on the earth and over millions of people and seeing nothing but evil.
Well, on a cosmic tug of war, it sounds like at this point in time that Satan is winning the battle. That he has captured more souls. Would that be the way to say it, Bob?
I think you could say it that way. The ultimate battle, what's at stake is this issue. Is God really God? And the test for that is not God himself, because he's invincible. He is God. But the test is his image. Right, we're his image, and constantly over that issue, the Lord has to defend us because our accuser, our slanderer, we have a rap sheet, and he's familiar with it, and he brings that before the Lord, you know, presents it to him, says, "This is your image. This, you look at what these guys are doing, right?" And so down through history, the Lord has looked for champions. He looks single person. He finds one in Noah. He'll find one in Abraham, founded in Moses. Job is the book, you know, par excellence, which explains that. Right. Job was a champion. But there's an ultimate champion coming. All of those are really pictures of Jesus Christ. In a sense, what Paul calls him in Corinthians, the second Adam, right?
Right?
The second man. This is God and man put together in one person with no mixture. And he, the devil's no match for him. So sometimes if you look at it numerically, yeah, the devil does a pretty good job of moving the ball up and down the field.
Right.
But quality-wise, no, the Lord's always won that contest.
Well, and I think he points it out. I mean, he makes it very clear that I will blot out man whom I have created.
Yeah. And he is going to do it. We're going to read about that in the next few weeks, the flood story. He does that, except for eight people, Noah and Noah's immediate family. But, yeah, he blots them out. And the race has been polluted. You know, you've got demonic activity interacting with human activity. It's a polluted race. He's going to clean that out.
And he finds favor with Noah?
Well, Noah finds favor with God. Right, in grace, God looked
down. Or the other, yes,
Noah,
I see, yeah.
Whose name means comfort, you know, Noah, consolation. So he's found a true champion here in Noah. Noah's a great guy, and we'll go through the whole flood story. That'll be fun. Let's keep one other thing in mind. the way, you know, as God looks down upon the earth, same now as he has done throughout history. What he's actually looking for is recorded in 2 Chronicles 16, verse 9. He's looking for a pure heart. He's looking for a heart that belongs to him. So any person listening could become one of the true champions. It takes a decision in your heart. And in fact, it might even be worth talking about, what is the heart? You know, when we say that, what is the human heart? And I think the way I would define that is there are really three components that define us inside. What we look like, what we do for work, those things are not essential to our identity. We think they are.
Right.
In pride was, oh, well, here's my card, you know, my business card, and it says, you know, CEO of whatever. You know, what if our business cards really told the truth? You know, you hand some guy your card and it says, Bob Brandon, sinner. There's my card. That's who I really am.
And the whole world would carry the same card, right?
Yeah. We all look the same on that level. But all that to say, so the three things that truly define us inside is from the Lord, as his image, we have intellect. We have emotions. And we have a will. And I believe the word heart, as it's used biblically, is the summary of those three things. It's our inner person. Your heart is your decision-making capacity, that you're a moral free agent. And your emotions and your intellect inform your will. But the heart is most directly refers to our will. That's guided by our emotions and our intellect to make decisions. So when the Lord looks down and sees the heart of man was only evil continually, he's devastated.
Oh yeah, crushed.
But also shows he has those feelings.
Right.
The Lord does have emotions. You can grieve him. You can please him. You know, he has all those things as our divine father.
Well, and I think it's written, you know, throughout history, this struggle, this isn't the first time this particular struggle is gonna be there. It's gonna come up in God's eyes that he looks down and he says, okay, guys, you know, we may have to regroup and start again one more time.
Yeah.
You know, because like you point out, there's not a plan B. There only is a plan A, and the plan A is to rule and subdue the earth. And unfortunately, as we point out in the cosmic battle over and over, there's another guy out there that he's thinking along the same lines as far as control and
yeah.
and diversion, I guess, and and really deception and all those.
He knows the way things really are. In other words, he knows the truth, and he'd like to obscure that.
Yeah.
And he'd like to put himself on the throne, and most of mankind follows him. He sounds good. So where is he, for instance? You know, how do you tangibly identify the devil today? And some of that can be dangerous kind of language, because it's all got to be understood with the nuance that about what I'm going to say. For instance, I want you to take it all the way, but I don't want you to take it too far. And I know that sounds like a paradox, but you know, where would you find the devil today? Well, you have to ask these kinds of questions to answer that. Well, who are today's truth tellers? Who do you turn to in our culture to tell you the truth? And most people in Western culture, in the United States, for instance, are going to say, you know, who really tells us the way things really are? That's the scientists, right?
Right.
And they've told us, you know, we evolved. We came from, you know, some cosmic slime, some of the molecules that make up DNA, some of those amino acids got together randomly, just through natural forces, formed a DNA molecule, and poof, here you have life in all its various forms. That's a lie.
Well,
that did not happen. And you can show that in so many ways. So when I say those people are from the devil, I don't mean, you know, go kill your biology professor. I'm fond of many of them. They don't know that they're tools for that. So you know what I'm saying? Don't take it too far. And yet, at the same time, push that all the way. That's how he would speak and mislead people today. So what does he say about the Bible? Well, just ask yourself, what does our culture say about the Bible? That's a good book.
Nice story.
It's a nice story. That's good. It'll teach you to be a good person. But is that literally the words of God? No. Come on. Give me a break. Right? And there's the devil.
And that's the rub.
Yeah. Anything that obscures the truth of God is him.
So it comes down to who are we allowing to be our truth tellers, in
That's
a
right.
sense.
You got to decide. You've got to have your stuff together enough that you can pierce through the veil of lies and discern the truth. So the way I like to say it is, what truth ultimately boils down to is source. You need a source of truth. You need to find someone who's never been wrong. And second quality, never lies. Right? And once you find that person, believe him no matter what. So let's put that all together. If God knows everything and he never lies, and you always believe him, how often would you be right? All the time.
All the time.
That is the only way to ultimately fight the cosmic battle. Now let's think about those items in succession again. If God knows everything, well, imagine if he doesn't. We're out.
We're in trouble.
Okay, if God's not omniscient, we're out. Okay? If God always tells the truth, well, let's imagine. Well, what if he lies? Well, we're out. And if we always believe him, now there's the rub. See, the first two are certain.
Right.
There is God, and he knows everything. Number two, he never lies. The rub is, are we going to believe him? And down through history, Eve dropped the ball on that, all of a sudden didn't believe him, so the whole world crashed, and each person ends up making that own decision for themselves in their own hearts, right?
And even today, and we've had this conversation before, but even looking at the chapter and verses that we're reading today, man tries to put himself in that throne. You know, my God. They create their own God in their mind without, you know, going through the book that introduces us to our Father.
That's
you know,
right.
Hey, that's the Bible. Is hey, here's Dad.
That's right. Meet Dad.
Right. And so many times we as humans try and control the picture of who Dad is.
Yeah. It's sort of like the phrase, if you've ever heard in popular discussion, about how involved should Christians be in the legal process in the United States and in government and so on. And a common refrain that we hear is, well, we don't want to impose our beliefs or our morality on other people. Somebody's going to.
Right.
Let me tell you, if the Christian doesn't do it, the next guy will. The atheist will impose his morality.
Right.
Somebody is going to write those laws. Might as well be God's laws. So somebody's going to do it. So in other words, the way I would apply that is, if you remove God from his throne in your own thinking for whatever reason, because you want to believe the scientists more than God or what have you, for whatever reason, if you do that, someone's going to sit on that throne. It is not going to remain empty. And what happens in most cases is the person themselves sits in that throne. Who ultimately is the truth teller? And most people would say, well, you know what, bottom line, I am. And every time I get to that point in a conversation with someone, I just am flabbergasted. Like, you've never been wrong. You've always been right. You got a 100 on every test you've ever taken. And no matter what the subject, and what a foolish thing, then, to think that you could sit on the throne of God. And yet, many of us do that. We dethrone the Lord and put ourselves on there.
Well, and as you pointed out, it's that how important this foundation that we're building right now in reading through the beginnings
That's
of the
right.
Bible.
That's right. That's why you don't want to pick it up and just start
right.
1,500 pages through. You want to get aware of this battle from the earliest pages.
And it's been raging since Genesis 3. I mean, it started there, and you see how quickly things do transgress.
That's right.
You know, the progress, the direction that we were put here to go automatically gets diverted.
Yeah. Well, that phrase, all contained in that phrase, when the Lord warned Adam and Eve, in the day that you do this, you will die. You'll begin to die. You know, evil will just proliferate so fast and so far that it'll take over. So,
so hot seat question today, how can we, as Christians, how can we pitch in on the cosmic battle, I guess is the way to put it.
Well, we've asked this one before, and that's a good one to keep asking. You know, I like to imagine someone in their car driving right now has never read the Bible before. And they're an adult, and they're aware of their own sinfulness, and they're aware of God's holiness. You know, they're aware they've got a problem with God, that those two things cannot coexist, their sin and God's holiness, that they're separate from God. How could you become attached to him as we were originally designed to be? Well, you get washed clean. And you get washed clean by believing the truth. And the truth is, as we continue to turn the pages in God's good book, that if a person's coming, he's going to pay the price himself for all of this. God himself is going to pay the price in the person of Jesus Christ. And the truth is that he lived a sinless life, that he died on the cross in our place, taking our own penalty upon himself, the sin of the whole world, paid for it, and then rose again from the dead triumphantly. So the price has been paid for our sin. We simply need to tap into that by believing the truth. When I say simply, it is a simple process. It has life-changing consequences. You can't believe that and then continue to lead, you know, a destitute life. It'll change what you do. Not that it will instantly become sinless, but you'll be aware of your sin, and you will progressively lead a more and more sanctified life until that day when we're in heaven with God and completely purified and perfected. But that's how you engage. That is the cosmic battle.
Well, as we bring this episode to a close, I want to remind all our listeners that you can become a fan of this podcast simply by going to the homepage of www.twomeninabible.podomatic.com and click on the Become a Fan button, and you will receive emails that update you whenever we've we've posted new episodes onto the site, and we'd love to have all of you, you know, share this podcast with someone else. That's the other way that we can engage, is by gathering numbers as well. So with that being said, Bob, I'd love it when you close us with your prayer. And
that's great. Thanks, Jimmy.
Lord,
so we've heard about this strange event in history. And strange as it is to our own minds, you've declared it to be true, and that there aren't truly heroes on earth other than the ones who are pure in heart, the ones that are the real salt of the earth, the ones who are humble, the ones you discussed in Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount. But we pray for the strength to engage in the cosmic battle, that you'd convict our hearts of sin, righteousness, and judgment, that we would turn to you, and simply put, we would believe in you. So thank you, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.